The following Dharma talk was recorded in August 2015 in Springfield, Illinois, from the retreat called Suffering and the End of Suffering, taught by Bridget Rollins. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Bridget Rollins has practiced insight meditation since 1997. Her mentors include Matthew Flickstein, Ginny Morgan, and Gloria Terania Ambrosia. She is recognized by the Spirit Rock Teachers Council as a community Dharma leader, and her website is www.pathwaystomindfulness.com.
Last night, in that quote from the Dhammapada, when the Buddha was saying, where can you find true refuge? And he said, when having gone to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha for refuge, you see with right discernment the Four Noble Truths. So he's saying that we take refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and we can understand that in many ways. And from that place of refuge, then we can view with wise discernment Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path that leads to the end of suffering. Well, this talk is coming largely from a talk by Stephen Batchelor, who is a Dharma teacher and also a Pali scholar. And, excuse me, there are a number of scholars who are trying to go back to the original text, the earliest Buddhist texts. And what Stephen said he's found is that in the very earliest texts, the word noble truth is not found. That what is said is something like the four. So it's not the Four Noble Truths, it's the four. And there's an advantage to taking the words noble truths off and just looking at these as the four, and we'll kind of explore perhaps why that can be helpful. So let's just kind of take it from here and see what would happen if we take noble truths out and just talk about the four. So in the the very first Dharma talk that the Buddha gave, right after his enlightenment, it's called Setting the Wheel of Dharma in Motion. He talks about the four, and he says the four are dukkha, sometimes translated as suffering. Stephen Batchelor, really, he says when you look at this translation of dukkha, dukkha's hard to translate because it's just so rich and it just doesn't quite fit into any of our English words. But he said, you know, he translates it as life. Samudaya, S-A-M-U-D-A-Y-A, which is arising, referring to the arising of desire. Nirodha, N-I-R-O-D-H-A, the stopping or the ceasing of desire. And Magga, M-A-G-G-A, path, or a way of living that flows from these three, but also a way of living that feeds into. So it's kind of a feedback loop or feed into loop. And the Buddha, in part of the discourse, describes the conditions that led to his awakening. And he said, as long as my knowledge and vision were not entirely clear about the 12 aspects of the four, I did not claim to have a peerless awakening in this world with its humans and celestials, its gods and devils, its ascetics and priests. Only when my knowledge and vision was clear in all these ways did I claim to have such an awakening. So you might be saying, what's this 12 aspects of the four? Or you may know the 12 aspects of the four and it's part of your practice. But for those of us for whom this is a new term, the 12 aspects of the four, there is actually each of the four, dukkha, arising, ceasing, and path, have three aspects connected with them. So the three aspects with regard to dukkha is, such is dukkha. That's first. It can be fully known. It has been fully known. Three aspects with regard to samudaya, the arising of craving. Such is the arising of craving. It can be let go of. It has been let go of. With respect to nirodha, the ceasing of craving, such is the experience of ceasing. It can be experienced. It has been experienced. And with regards to the path, such is the path. And he's referring to the Noble Eightfold Path. It can be cultivated. It has been cultivated. And he said, once he had fully understood these four within these 12 aspects, he said, and so there arose in me illumination about things previously unknown. And as we go back to, he said that until he wasn't entirely clear, he couldn't say that, he said, I could not claim to have a peerless awakening, an awakening that wasn't found anywhere else. That's the peerless part. So we get the pattern here. There's a nice little pattern. The first element is recognition. Okay? So, and that's the such. Such is dukkha. Such is the rising of craving. Such is the ceasing of craving. Such is the path. And so there has to be first that recognition. The second is there's something you can do about it. There's something to be done about it. And so there's a task. And the third element is that which can be done about whatever has been done. So whatever needs to be done about these four, and I'm not even going to say anything after that, these four, when we get to the point where we can say everything that needed to be done about this has been done, we're probably a fully awakened person just like the Buddha. So the Buddha's awakening, and this can be inspiration for us, comes from having fully known dukkha, having let go of craving, having experienced the stopping of craving, and having cultivated the Noble Eightfold Path. So there we have a little manual of instruction on how to get enlightened. And Stephen Batchelor said he's put together a little acronym that I have placed on the message board. And he was saying it's probably more helpful to think about the four as four noble tasks rather than four noble truths. So it's not that these are truths that somehow you have to believe in. Because if we set them up as truths, then there can always be some argument. Well, no, is that really true? I don't know. You say life is suffering. I have a lot of fun times. You know, how can you say life is suffering? So we can get into arguments about whether that's true or not. And just remembering, the Buddha said, even about himself, don't believe anybody just because they're saying it. So the Buddha was not telling us, this is what you should believe in, and then you'll be a good person. Or, by believing in it, you're going to be free. I don't think, now, I'm not a Pali scholar, so there may be something in there, but I haven't yet heard that the Buddha said the way to an awakened mind and heart, the way to liberation, is to find a set of beliefs and believe in them. What he did say was, take what I'm telling you and put it into action. So the idea of Four Noble Tasks really goes right with that. The Buddha's saying, okay, when I did these actions and all the way to the end of completion, doing whatever needed to be done, I awoke. And I experienced and continue to experience freedom from suffering. So here they are. Take them for a test drive. And see what happens for you. And so I want to echo the Buddha and invite us as we continue on the retreat now to address these four tasks. And we can call them noble tasks if we want, because they are noble. They bring about the nobility of freedom in us. So the acronym is ELSA, E-L-S-A. Good old ELSA. Maybe she's a relation of Donna. So it's embracing, letting go, stopping, and acting. Embracing reality, what is, letting go of the craving that arises. The stopping isn't us stopping the craving. The stopping is being aware that there is a stopping, that craving is ceasing, and then acting, and I put in parentheses, wisely. The Noble Eightfold Path gives us a little manual of how to act and what to cultivate if we would like to experience freedom. So in this talk, I'd like to focus on the first two of the four. And as I mentioned before, Stephen Batchelor translates the word dukkha. Sometimes he'll say suffering, but he said, you know, I just like to kind of think of it as life. And if we look at an explanation of what is meant by that first of the four, when I look at it, it looks like, the first of the four is talking about human experience. And so the first task is to embrace our human experience. So if we embrace human experience, what might we be up for? Well, we're going to embrace the fact that we got born. Okay, so that's the first thing. We're going to embrace the fact of aging, fact of death, the fact that if you get born into a human body, you will probably get sick along the way. And I was thinking, this isn't usually in the text, but, you know, you'll get hot, you'll get cold, you'll get tired, you'll get itchy, you'll get all of those things. So this is just reality. We will be separated from what we love, what we want. Has anyone not had that experience yet? Okay. We'll have to associate with what we don't like. Does that ring true to your experience? Yeah. And we won't always get what we want. This is life. There's nothing wrong. You know, I mean, the reaction of the worldly is to get all up in arms about this. And when we're in that space, we're usually getting really agitated and upset and scared and angry. This is the way it is. This is the Dhamma, the truth of the way things are. And I've also reflected, this isn't in any of the suttas, but actually Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist, and he wrote a book called Buddha's Brain. And he was just kind of chuckling, I think, about the paradox that here we are in a mind and a body that's hardwired to survive. I mean, there's this huge drive for survival, but what is the only reality besides taxes that we can be sure of? this body is going to die. What a paradox. That our nervous system is hardwired to seek pleasure and avoid pain. And it's trying to find happiness by that. And yet, this drive, seek pleasure, avoid pain, actually keeps us in a constant state of agitation. I think somewhere there's the image of the monkey hopping from tree to tree to tree to tree, trying to find that sweet banana. There's a Sufi wise fool, and does anyone remember his name? Is it Neruda? Nasruddin, not Neruda, Nasruddin. And there's the story that he's got this huge pile of peppers, and he's eating them, and they're hot, and his face is red, sweat's pouring off, and he just keeps eating one after the other, and they say, Nasruddin, why do you keep on eating those hot peppers? You're suffering terribly. And he says, I'm trying to find the sweet one. And you know, just isn't that part of the being in this human condition? Dukkha. Dukkha is the human condition in this way of understanding dukkha. I think of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs. And once we get past basic food, clothing, shelter, water, that kind of thing, you know, it seems that there is this need for stability, for security, for safety. And yet, what is one of the marks of human existence? Impermanence. You know, everything is always changing. There's no place to, you know, actually come down and have solid ground under us. So again, another paradox where our humanity is geared towards seeking this, and yet we can get relative states, but we can never get, you know, that solid, safe security that nothing's going to change. And psychologically, there is the drive and the development, and it's a very healthy thing for individuality. I've heard Dharma teachers say that you have to have a healthy ego, a healthy sense of self, in order to let go of self. And so it's part of being human and actually functioning well in the human realm is to develop this sense of self, to come to an acceptance and a kindness towards that self. And this is the work of psychology, you know, to help that happen. However, everything that's making up the self or the view of self, the idea of self, is not self. And to become attached or identified with any of that creates suffering. So many paradoxes. As I was reflecting, what came into my mind too is if we want to translate dukkha in this context as life, is the eight worldly winds. Are you familiar with those? The Buddha talked about in this life, he called them eight worldly winds because they kind of buffet us around. So he said, in this life, you will experience pain and pleasure, gain and loss, success and failure, praise and blame. And he said, you ain't going to get out of life without experiencing all of that. And yet, who wants to experience pain, loss, failure, blame? However, this is what is. I find this very helpful, especially with the fame and the success and fame. Because, again, it's very human to want to succeed. It's very human to want to have the approval of others. And it can be a trap because there's the craving, the clinging to having that, what we might say, the positive side of everything and avoid the negative. And I have found it very freeing, you know, to just acknowledge and embrace. You know what, Bridget? It's okay if people don't like you. That's a real eye-opener. I didn't know that at one time. Didn't know I could be safe with people not liking me. But you know what? You can fall flat on your face, and probably you will survive. These are not things that need to be feared. It's just, oh yeah. And I'll notice when I'm getting praise that, it's not that I come in and say, oh, well, don't hold on to that because, you know, you're going to get blamed and don't get attached to that. But it's just kind of, oh, that's very nice. And now I can be open to the next thing, which might be blame. Oh, that success was very nice. But I don't have to get attached to it. I can relax and be open to the next thing and not fear if the next thing is failure or if the next thing is unpleasant or if the next thing is some kind of loss. And the Buddha said, if we understand this and remain open to it all, no matter what it is, that what we're doing is we're cultivating equanimity. And equanimity, when we are relating to the world, to other people, to ourselves, from equanimity, we're at peace. That opens up to a deep peace. So we can look at the first task, embracing dukkha, within this context. The second task, samudaya, and I'm using these Pali words, because that's what Stephen Batchelor did, and it's sometimes kind of not nice to know what the original language was, but I'm also spelling it so you know what it is. And this is referring to the arising of craving. As we engage in the conditions of life, so dukkha, that first task of embracing life, if we are fully embracing life, we're going to see that craving, desire arises. Desire arises, and as it kind of strengthens, you know, we can say, oh, there's desire. And as it gets stronger, it becomes craving. And if it becomes more, even more strong, we're to the point of clinging to getting the object of the desire and being attached to getting to the object. And the farther we go out from just the simple arising of the desire, the more suffering we're creating for ourselves. Or at least that's my experience. You see what your experience is about that. And one way the Buddha talked about craving was three kinds of craving or desire. The craving for sense pleasure, the craving for being or becoming, and the craving for non-being or non-becoming. So, anybody not understand sense pleasure? What sense pleasure is? I didn't see any hands go up. Yeah, so we've got these sense organs, and eyes like to see beautiful sights, pleasant sights. Ears like to hear pleasant sounds. Noses like to smell pleasant odors, fragrances, aromas. The taste receptors in the tongue like to have sweet and salty and pleasant tastes. This body likes pleasant touch sensation, touch experiences. The body likes pleasant sensations, you know, within the body. It likes to be just the right temperature. It likes to have no aches or pains. So all of our senses. And then the mind is in within the Buddhist understanding of sense organs is a sense organ. And minds like to have pleasant thoughts. Actually, minds get a kick out of thinking. And, you know, it's just kind of, the mind just likes to be entertained. I think Matt Flickstein said that one time. Our minds like to be entertained. And so when there's nothing and no thoughts are coming, if there is a desire for pleasure, you know, then the mind might kick in and start, you know, munching on something. There is an opposite side to the desire for, which is the desire to not have unpleasant sensual experiences. So that's the desire with regards to sense pleasure. And then there is this desire or this craving for being or becoming. And if we examine our experience, we will probably see that. First of all, most of us, we can understand the craving for being. We want to exist. You know, we want to live another day, be alive. The craving for non-being could be, I don't want to live. You know, suicide comes from that. Or just staying in bed and pulling the covers up over and just not addressing it. So there can be those two desires, and it can be on the level of existence, life. There's another sense of becoming and non-becoming. So have you ever found yourself perhaps worrying or feeling anxious, feeling uptight? And if you look at what's happening, you're uptight because you want to become someone who is perhaps getting that new house. Or you want to become someone who is going to get a raise. Or you want to become someone who, and just fill in the blank. So there's this projection of a self that we want to become. And we're not saying any of this is evil or bad. I mean, this is what happens in a human life. That we will tend to, you know, kind of say, well, yeah, here's my 10-year strategy. These are the goals that I have for myself. Nothing wrong with that. However, let's look to our experience as that's going on. Is it simply a good plan that's coming up in the mind? Or as that's arising, is there tension? You know, is there a tightness? Is there some anxiety that's going along, some fear of not becoming that? Then we're probably attached to that, and attachment is a cause for the arising of suffering. So this becoming, and then the non-becoming, you know, well, I sure don't want to be like that. We might see someone and say, whoa, I sure don't want to be like that. I don't want to become that kind of person. You know, I don't want to become a person of advanced years who has to depend on someone to bathe me. So there is the craving for non-becoming in that way. Another area of becoming and non-becoming, for me, is it's like there's the desire for the next moment to be a particular way. And it might be the next immediate moment or, you know, the next day, the next week, the next year. And so I'm wanting that to be a particular way. And I'm probably wanting pleasure, gain, success, and fame in some form. So the wanting of that future to become what I want. And then there is the opposite. You know, I don't want this to happen. You know, I don't want the car to stop functioning so that I have to get another car and have to be paying car payments. Now, there's nothing wrong with having the preference for having a car that operates fine. There's nothing wrong with a preference, with knowing what it is that I would like. The suffering comes to the extent, and you notice as I do that, my body's leaning forward, is to the extent that I'm reaching and grasping at that. When I can let go and say, you know, if I had my druthers, this car, I've got a Honda Civic. I've had it for 10 years. It just passed 250,000 miles. And I'm hoping that we go for 500,000 because I wouldn't mind driving this car till I die, you know, which could be that that will happen. And it wasn't because it got to 500,000 miles. So that grasping for the becoming, or that it's kind of like the mind goes out into the future and either gets attached to the future being this way or attached to the future not being this way. And just notice, do you feel free in those moments? Do you feel calm and at peace in those moments when the attachment is strong? If you do, then please, by all means, continue to cultivate and practice craving and attachment. Really, I'm kind of being a little facetious. However, part of gaining wisdom is sometimes to completely explore what everybody is saying is not skillful. Now, you may not want to explore what happens if I step into the middle of a fire, you know. But there are some things that, you know, maybe I'm actually going to go to that in a bit with a wonderful little discourse that the Buddha gave. Okay, so our task, you know, is to embrace life on life's terms. Matthew Flickstein talked about the four. The first is embracing life on life's terms. That wasn't it. The first was life is problematic. The second was we suffer when we want things to be other than what they are. The third was we cease suffering when we can accept life on life's terms. And the fourth was there is a path of practice that sets us up for freedom, that brings us to the end of suffering. So, do I do this or not? Okay, I am going to do this. And you're wondering, what is this? Okay, so I'm going to say a word, and I'd like to invite you to tell me what's the first thing that comes up, either as a thought or an image or maybe a physical reaction. Some of you have done this before. Okay, so are you ready for the word? Everybody listening? Renunciation. What came up?
Renunciation.
Going into the convent.
I can't do what I want.
Don't want to.
Acceptance. The image of the Virgin Mary.
Okay. Hey, that was what came through. The image of the Virgin Mary.
Stepping away.
Pardon? Stop. Anything else? For some, it was just blank. Okay. So, The word renunciation in English, for some of us, and I expect this is some of us who have studied Dharma and the value of renunciation, you know, there may be these, there's acceptance, there's the stopping, there's the letting be acceptance. But we might notice that sometimes, don't want to, go into the convent, I want what I want, that there may not be this wholesome, what we might say, wholesome reaction. So I want to share with you one of my favorite suttas in the whole thing. And it's a conversation between the Buddha and the householder Tapusa. This was a lay follower of the Buddha. So the Buddha must have given a talk on renunciation. So Tapusa says, "Sir, we are householders who indulge in sensuality, delight in sensuality, enjoy sensuality, rejoice in sensuality. For us, indulging in sensuality, delighting, enjoying, rejoicing in sensuality, renunciation seems like a sheer drop-off." I'm with you, Tapusa. Why'd you have to give that talk, Buddha? "Yet, I have heard that in this doctrine and discipline, the hearts of the very young monastics leap up at renunciation, grow confident, steadfast, and firm, seeing it as peace." So right here is where this doctrine and discipline is contrary to the great mass of people. Would you say maybe that in Western society at least, or in the United States, that renunciation probably doesn't get greeted with hearts leaping up and seeing, oh, yeah, renunciation, that's the way to peace. I was, I brought Joyce today, and I was in the parking lot of a little grocery store. It was so funny. Here I am going over this talk. Right in front of me, a big poster with Newport cigarettes. And right across the front of it, pleasure. And then way down here, Surgeon General's warning, which they didn't even say smoking causes lung cancer, heart disease. One of the other little signs did. No, it said, "Quitting smoking now greatly reduces serious risks to your health." Which is a positive way to say that. But as an addict, that's not going to do it for me. And then there was yet another one for Newport Smooth Select. I guess that's, you know, one of their other brands of, and not just pleasure, but it was flavorful, refreshing pleasure. And the warning there was cigarette smoke contains carbon monoxide. So we can see that this doctrine and discipline is contrary to the great mass of people, and maybe sometimes we are part of that great mass of people. So the Buddha, I just love how the Buddha responded. So human. He actually says, "So it is, so it is. Even I myself, before my awakening, when I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, I thought renunciation is good." You know, and probably nobody here would say, "Oh no, renunciation is a terrible thing to do." Yeah, renunciation is good, but my heart didn't leap up at renunciation. The Buddha didn't come already awakened, didn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace. The thought occurred to me, what is the cause? What is the reason why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation? Grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace. Then the thought occurred to me, I haven't seen the drawback of sensual pleasure. I haven't pursued that theme. I haven't understood the reward of renunciation. I haven't familiarized myself with it. That's why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation, seeing it as peace. Then the thought occurred to me, if having seen the drawback of sensual pleasures, I were to pursue that theme, And if, having understood the reward of renunciation, I were to familiarize myself with it, there is the possibility that my heart would leap up at renunciation, grow confident, steadfast and firm, seeing it as peace. And I believe, if I remember correctly, the sutta does go on, and he said, and that's what I did. And so now today, you know, I'm like those young monastics. I hear the word renunciation, and I just get all kinds of happiness. But notice, the Buddha at one point in his development, in his journey to freedom, could intellectually say, yeah, renunciation is good. It's something I should do. And have you ever noticed when you should on yourself, there's resistance? You know, okay, I should practice renunciation. I really should. Okay, practice renunciation. Maybe tomorrow. Well, but let me just have this last hot fudge sundae, the triple decker, you know, with three scoops of ice cream and gazillion pounds of chocolate. You know, that there is that part of our development. The Buddha said, if you want to really get to the place where the practice of renunciation is something that becomes a part of your life, and you get to enjoy the rewards, and the word renunciation, another way to translate it, is letting go. So it might be that because in our language renunciation has an awful lot of on top of it, we might want to let go of renunciation, let go, and substitute letting go. What we're letting go of is that attachment to getting sensual pleasure, to the attachment to becoming, the attachment to non-becoming. And this is another thing, you know, don't believe it just because Bridget said it, because she heard Stephen Batchelor say it, because he read the Pali text, and because the Buddha said it. All the teachers are saying, explore it for yourself, see for yourself. We've got an intellectual understanding of it at this point, but intellectual understanding never yields to liberation. It's our actual experience that will lead to liberation. And those of us who love Gloria Taranilla as a teacher might remember that she's fond of saying the mind needs good, clean data about suffering and the cessation of suffering before it becomes willing to abandon its attachment to pleasure. So as we continue our retreat now, we're about ready to go into lunchtime. I would encourage you to set a loving aspiration to create a continuity of mindfulness. You know, meditation, that's a formal time. But rather than seeing all the times in between as, you know, okay, I'm going to do something and then I'll come back to my practice, let the entire day, every moment of this retreat day, be a moment of practice. And perhaps what we can do is do what the Buddha said. Really look at our experience to see what are the drawbacks of indulging in sensuality. What are the drawbacks of becoming attached to sense desire, sense pleasure. And keep an open mind, you know. And then we might want to, instead of grasping and having that pleasure, we might try letting go of a few of those. And stay present to our experience and notice, okay, what happens when I let go? And just be with whatever is arising with the letting go and stay with it. You know, not let go, oh no, this feels terrible, and grab it back. No, just let yourself be with the letting go over a period of time. You know, and see for ourselves, is there any drawback? in this habit that perhaps I think all humans have, this habit of grasping at what we want, pushing away what we don't want. What happens when we let go and be with life on life's terms? And just let that inform our practice as we go into lunch. So being fully present to the, eating can also often be a wonderful, you know, cornucopia of sensual pleasure, sight, sound, smell, feeling in the body when you're really hungry and take that first bite and it hits the stomach and your body goes, experiment. Undertake these tasks, these first two tasks of embracing the moment. You know, what is life? What do they say? Life is what's happening when we're planning other things. Well, how about if we let go of the planning of other things just for today, or, you know, just for the lunch period, whatever we can sustain, and keep coming back to embracing life as it is right now. My full experience, body, mind, heart. And watch, so we embrace life. If we're really embracing life and showing up for right now, we're probably at some point we're going to notice the arising of craving. And as that arises, can we let go of the grasping and just be with the arising and see what happens? Okay. Any questions about what we're doing? No? Okay.
I have a question, not so much about what you're doing, but you said it was just the four. Is it just the eight?
The eight.
Yeah, like there's no noble path.
It would be, well, we could call it a noble path. But rather than saying the noble truth of the path, we're kind of saying it's the noble task of the path. And you could just let go of all of that and just say there is the eight. And what is the task that goes along with the eight? It's cultivating the eight. Yeah, cultivating that.